Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, as hundreds of young hopefuls prepare for the Beijing Olympics, there's been consistent talk of China's human rights abuses and questions over whether our athletes should actually make a stand, maybe even boycott. The scenario isn't new, though. In 1980, the Fraser government called for a boycott of the Moscow Games, and a then 16-year-old Lisa Forrest was right in the middle of it. Her book, Boycott, has just been released, and she joins us now. Lisa, welcome to Open House.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Boy, a teenager stuck in the middle of that, hey?
I think that sometimes when you're a teenager, you can be very black and white about things, and that might help you get through things like this. Yeah. And I think at 16, you could say, this is clearly wrong, what they're doing to us. Say, the Olympics is about peace, and that's as good a thing to believe in as anything in this moment. Certainly not a politician raving about, you know, yes, being the greatest threat since World War II.
Yeah, well, I'll be interested to know your reflections in the years since. But, I mean, let's just set the scene. So it's 1979. Moscow invades Afghanistan.
The last days of 79, yeah. So right at the end.
The upcoming Olympics are kind of seen almost as some sort of Soviet propaganda parade.
Yeah.
And the Australian government of the day campaigns for a boycott. And here you are, 16 years old. You're captain of the women's swimming team.
Yeah.
What emotions went through you during that time? You said, you know, okay, black and white thinking, and so, oh, it's just clearly wrong. But what emotions did go through you during that
time? Well, I think it's a roller coaster. And one of the difficulties for the book was writing about that and trying not to be too sort of indulgent. It was a very difficult thing to write about because essentially I went and I was determined to go. But it didn't mean that, you know, there weren't days when you were incredibly sluggish in the water, when you couldn't work out. I mean, when you say I was captain of the team, I didn't actually make the team until March of that year, the same time as the trials that we've just had. Mm. So for the first 3 months of the year, while the Prime Minister was calling for support for the US, essentially, it was President Carter who'd said that if the Soviets do not withdraw on the February 20, then Americans will not be in Moscow. So the first 3 months, you could just concentrate on making the team. There wasn't too much point in worrying about it until you made the Olympic team. Once that happened, from March until June, that was a very difficult time. And, you know, we had a whistle by the telephone because we had death threats. Other swimmers that I was, you know, in camp with were getting their letters. Max Metzger got his threats by letter saying it was worse than the sewage being pumped into Maroubra Beach. Mark Tonelli was a very vocal and very vibrant member of our team. And so, you know, in many ways, I just wanted to emulate those boys, Graham Brewer, Max Metzger, Ron McKeon, Mark Tonelli. They were outspoken. We were very intelligent men. And I just wanted to, you know, keep up with them in a sense, you know, and make sure that I was saying the right thing as well. But they were incredibly difficult times, and I think that you don't actually understand what you've been through, particularly then. There was no such thing as a sports psychologist. You know, that person didn't exist in Australia at the time.
Good point.
Yeah, and so it wasn't until, say, the lead up to 1984, I didn't make that next team, and I didn't try for it. I actually retired about 10 weeks before Olympic trials, and I just thought that, you know, I just wasn't tough enough. Back in those days, that was a saying, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, and I used to think, oh, well, I wasn't tough enough and it must be my fault, but I couldn't find motivation. Whereas now, you know, on reflection, I suppose a sports psychologist just could have unpacked that really easily and thought, you know, got to the point where I didn't actually want to put myself through that again. It's probably, you know, the most awful time of my life, really, those months. Mm. And just because you had all these ideas of what preparing for Olympic Games would be like, and that just didn't meet any of those expectations, I can tell you.
Well, especially having a whistle by the phone because of death threats.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot for a 16-year-old to take. And who were they coming from?
Your sister, you know, to pick up the phone and answer one of those calls, or your mum, you know, 40-year-old mum. And I think that they are amazing, really. And when I started writing Boycott, I actually had up on my, you know, sort of had the acknowledgements right at the beginning, or at least the dedication. It was always to mum and dad, just because I thought, I'll write this as a love letter to them, especially now maybe that I'm an adult and I'm a parent. Like, imagine going through that when you're 40 years old, picking up the phone and having someone scream at you that your child won't come home just because she wants to go to the Olympic Games.
Yeah. And again, setting the scene, the government, the Fraser government, actually wouldn't force a boycott.
No.
They left it up to the Australian Olympic Federation. Now, that really put them in quite a bind, didn't it? It was quite a dilemma that they faced.
Well, there were many people that criticised the Olympic Federation because they took so long. They allowed us. In many ways, they kind of continued this will they, won't they? And, you know, they were supposed to meet on, they met on April the 19th for an annual general meeting. They were supposed to make a decision then. They decided to delay the decision. And so it really just kept us hanging on and not knowing what was going to happen. And so I mean, Judy Patching, you know, in the books talks about it being a difficult, evolving situation and something they wanted to sort of be on top of, but really it just left us open for more and more criticism, I think.
But they really also faced the dilemma that the Australian swimming team hadn't done so well in previous years, so they needed a win. Yeah. At the same time, there was all this political pressure not to be a part of the Moscow Games.
That was, it just happened to be that this boycott and this request to boycott came in the dying amateur days of sport. We had our performances in Montreal was the worst performance in four decades by an Australian Olympic team. We didn't bring home a gold medal. The AOF had gone into the business of marketing for the first time, and the figures now are just ludicrous. You know, it's $1 million, a couple of $1 million that Sid Grange presided over compared to, you know, $17 or $18 million I think John Coates has to send this team to Beijing, and that's just the AOC. That's not everything else. The total amount wasn't much, but it did include some government money. And so for the first time, the government had contributed to sending the team or preparing the team for a few hundred thousand dollars. And so many sports associations, particularly those sports associations who eventually withdrew their athletes without any consultation with the athletes, shooting, equestrian, yachting, hockey did that. You know, they were able to say, well, if we want the government to support us, we should do what the government wants us to do. That was an argument that was very well used and widely used back then.
Because, yeah, I mean, many of the teams actually were pretty much paid off to support the boycott, weren't they?
The word was compensation at the time, not bribe, but compensation to go to an alternate event, whatever that is, to the Olympic Games. And for those people, very difficult. People like Jeff Davidson, one of the yachtsmen. Well, the yachtsmen. I mean, these were men who were, you know, in their late 20s. They had businesses. They had they ran plumbing businesses. You know, their wives kept them going while they built and crewed their own yachts, and they paid for it themselves. And then suddenly for the AYF to turn around and say, sorry, you're not going. I mean, you know, like, it decimated Olympic yachting for many, many years. The hockey men, Rick Charlesworth was in the team. They'd won a silver medal in 1976. They were the best performers in Montreal. Thought that they would go for gold, you know, in Moscow. And then to have the Hockey Association do a deal with the government, $100,000, it was worth more after the 6-5 decision by the AOF to withdraw from the team. I think the yachtsmen got about $52,000 that the AYF got. And then after the 6-5 decision, hockey got $100,000 and the women got $45,000. So the equestrian the same, $125,000 as compensation. Then individual athletes that also withdrew, like Raelynn Boyle and Tracy Wickham, they got $6,000 each. The money was very divisive. It was very divisive within within sports. You know, there were many of us who felt that, you know, okay, if you're going to withdraw and on a principle, then that's fine. But then why take the money? And then others said, well, you know, we're amateur athletes. You know, we've never been given anything before. You might as well take it.
Mm. Lisa Forrester's with us on Open House. She faced the boycott question at the 1980s Moscow Olympics, and it's a very interesting story been written up in this book called Boycott. So, Lisa, you've got a bit of a bit of empathy for the current batch of Olympians who are also feeling maybe not quite as much pressure as you did, but for maybe to make a stand against China.
Of course, I have a lot of empathy. Yeah, I mean, it's easy for the. I heard Kevin Gospel a couple of weeks ago say that, you know, the IOC doesn't ask for this to happen, but, you know, I believe that when you give the games to Beijing, you know what you're going to do, you know what you're doing, and you know that your athletes will become the meat in the sandwich. And the people who are calling for boycotts, one of the quotes from back then from, I think it was the Financial Review in March, said, boycott is a blunt, onomatopoeic word that elicits emotion. And, and it does, and it makes you feel like you are doing something. I mean, I was at the pool the other morning, and a woman that I know who's a triathlete, you know, she's very, very active in sport, and she was saying to me, well, I think we should boycott, Lisa. You know, I just don't think it's right. And, you know, that's a person who loves sport, who feels, you know, that this should be done. But as I said to her, well, yeah, but what are you doing? What personally are you doing? Are you not buying Chinese products? Are you writing to the CEO of these companies, of Australian companies that are over there? Are there other ways that we are going to let what we feel about China be known? And that's what we were saying back then. You know, we were still trading wool, wheat, a mineral called rutile, which was used to make sophisticated warheads. Why just use the athletes? I think the South African issue had been very prominent. A lot of people feel, well, that brought down apartheid. But in fact, sporting boycotts did not bring down apartheid. There were economic sanctions. I was speaking to Genevieve Pico, one of our best-known actresses, the other day. They were very strong. The Actors Federation, the Actors what would it have been called then? It was MIA now, but, you know, the Actors Union not letting producers sell their product to South Africa. So the Maritime Services Union were not letting oil get to the country. So it was a number of issues, community-based issues, responses that eventually had that outcome, whereas that's not what's happening in Moscow, and it's certainly not what's happening in Beijing, you know.
Yeah.
So very difficult for the athletes, but ultimately I think that sport is a wonderful way to bridge the gap that politicians break, you know, bridge the wall that politicians quite often break
okay.
down.
So you don't think there's ever a role for athletes to make a stand and actually boycott something? You think their role is almost to build the bridge rather than to
I think that the sport has been more often used in a positive way to build bridges. I think that if there was a concerted effort by the entire community, then it would be different, and athletes would go, okay, well, we can understand that, you know, this is part of a whole community response. But for the athletes to be expected to shoulder the sort of moral obligations of a society, then I don't agree with that, no.
Okay, what did you think of the various kerfuffles that we had surrounding the flame?
Well, I thought that it was very interesting and very emotional, and I'm not a huge fan of the torch, really. I don't really get it. I, as an athlete, I wanted to know that it was lit in Athens and that it arrived in the stadium, you know, and sort of was lit that day. I sometimes think you can milk some of these symbols a little bit too much. But I understand why people are protesting. I totally understand it. And I understand that, you know, I live in a democracy and I think that it's absolutely appropriate that you get out and you do make your feelings felt. I do think, though, that ultimately it's the flame of the Olympic Games. It's not China. And I think that I have no problem with the demonstration as long as it's peacefully done and as long as the person who's holding the flame is not attacked, you know.
Sure. Well, a few years have passed since then and your life has certainly taken a number of turns, but this latest book, Boycott, is, I guess, the culmination of so much of that experience. Good to talk to you, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, it's author and broadcaster Lisa Forrest. She faced the boycott question at the 1980s Moscow Olympics. This is not a new topic at all. She recounts the story through that book, Boycott. It's published through ABC Books.
We hope you enjoy this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.